I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this month, a peer-reviewed paper was set to be published in the journal Biological Conservation that detonated shockwaves around the world as people took in the blunt and alarming statistics presented in the paper. Over 40% of insect species are threatened with extinction. Insects are dying off in terms of actual mass on the planet at a rate of 2.5% a year, which, when they extrapolated out, would mean the near total elimination of insects in less than 100 years. Quote, unless we change our ways of producing food, insects as a whole will go down the path of extinction in a few decades, write Francisco Sanchez Bayo at the University of Sydney in Australia and Chris Weikhouse at the China Academy of Agricultural Sciences in Beijing in this paper. And extinction of all insects, to say the least, would be very, very bad. Other researchers have since come out and said they don't totally agree with the premise of this paper, which takes some studies and applies them to all insect populations. These researchers point out that some insects are likely to survive even the toughest of conditions. And most of the studies that they looked at have been done on a rather limited geographic range around the planet. Nonetheless, it doesn't take the mass extinction of all the insects on the planet to cause massive problems for our ecosystems and for human agriculture and our economy. So what do we actually know about what's happening with insects around the world? What's the status of pollinators and other important insects here in our region? And is there anything we can be doing to slow or mitigate the damage as individuals or as larger government entities? Joining us to go through these questions today are three people steeped in the world of insects. Leif Richardson is an ecologist at UVM's Gund Institute for Environment and the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources. His work focuses on plants and pollinators and the consequences of bee declines. Leif, it's nice to talk with you again.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Brian Pfeiffer is also with us, a field entomologist and writer, frequent guest here on Vermont Edition. Brian, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be here.
And Mark Ferguson is a zoologist with Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department. Mark, it's a pleasure to have you here as well.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
So, Brian Pfeiffer, are we in the sixth great mass extinction right now? I mean, can we say definitively we are in it?
Yeah, and even if we do, insects will survive it. that's the amazing thing. These animals have been on the planet for 400 million years or so, which is about 2,000 times longer than we have. And they've already survived five mass extinctions. And, dinosaurs were a passing fad to them. and if we are in the middle of one of these great mass extinctions, insects will survive it. They are durable animals, far more durable than us. But that we're talking about this and we're talking in apocalyptic terms about insects suggests that our footprint is pretty powerful if we can have an impact on these animals that have been here for so long and are so durable.
And Brian, do you have a sense of why insects are declining more precipitously than other types of animals? Is it just because there are so many kinds of insects, or is it something specific to human activity that really affects insects more than some of the megafauna that's been studied and other animals that we know are facing threats as well?
Yeah, I think we can say with fair amount of certainty that it is largely human activity. We can talk about those drivers in a bit. But the amazing thing now, and I think one of the reasons this is getting so much attention, is that we haven't known much about insects, despite their being here for so long. We're only now beginning to understand what's happening with their distributions and their populations. They're just not things that we've studied for a long time. There are lots of biologists who have studied sort of individual insects or some of the charismatic groups like butterflies, for example, and moths, or the economically critical groups like bees and other pollinators. So we've known about them, but taken as a whole, this massive group of organisms, more diverse than any other, we're only now starting to get a sense of these population trends and, as a result, trying to come up with some explanations for them. And we do have some explanations.
So, Leif Richardson, I know you're among the people who wants to pump the brakes a little bit on what people have been hearing from this study. And it's set to be published in the April edition of this journal, but it's all come out. And so people are looking at this and saying, holy smokes, we could see every insect on the planet be gone in 100 years. And Brian is saying, probably not, given how well insects have survived in the past. But a lot of insects could be gone, and especially insects that are really crucial to human existence. So how do you see this report itself, and where we should take certain things with a grain of salt while also being very concerned about insects in general?
Yeah, Jane, I think that I largely agree with Brian that, yes, we probably are in the sixth great extinction event, and that insects are in trouble, along with many other taxa. This publication has generated a lot of discussion because it makes claims that, like the one that you just talked about, that insects will be gone within a century, that many of us just don't find plausible, given the evidence that the paper marshals. And so, yes, there are probably very serious issues with insect declines that we need to talk about. But no, it's unlikely, or at least there is no evidence. There is not enough evidence to suggest that all insects will be gone in a century. So I don't think it has to be one of those things or the other. And it's important. It's good that we are focusing on this issue now. I'm really glad about that. But I think it's important that we talk about what we know, not our worst fears. And so this paper, one thing it does, it's actually a really great review of the drivers of insect decline and what is known about individual taxa. So I think it's good work. But the frame of the paper was to search for articles about insects, declines, and something like long-term monitoring. And so that's not wrong, but if you do that, you will find studies that report declines of insects. You won't find studies necessarily that report increases of insects, right? So the paper was designed to look at what we know about declines, not to ask the question, are they declining or not? And the popular press, I think, has run with the idea that this is a novel report of the fact that insects are in decline, when it is actually just a review of the known literature.
Well, and the known literature is still small compared to all of the insects out in the planet and all of the places where insects live, right? So part of the issue here is studies have been done in certain parts of the world. There have been a lot of studies in Europe and North America, but fewer studies in Africa and in South America, where, you know, we just don't know. You can't necessarily extrapolate what you know from a study in France to a study in Argentina.
Yeah, that's right. So
yeah.
We think there are more than 5 million insect species on Earth, and about 80% of those are still undescribed. So not only have we not asked the question, are they in decline, we don't even know what their names are, right? So we've done many of these studies in the north temperate parts of the world and the developed world, particular types of landscapes, and we have a lot of focus on some very important groups of insects, including terrestrial butterflies and moths, the hymenoptera, which is bees, ants, and wasps, and some others that we can talk about. But there are other groups that we just haven't looked at yet. So I think a key theme to this discussion is the uncertainty that exists. So we know there's a problem, but it's impossible to say just how big the problem is, given how much uncertainty there is.
Mark Ferguson, from the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department perspective, do you look at a report like this and think, uh-oh, or do you say, good, people are paying attention to this, let's make hay now because this is something that's on people's minds and maybe we can make some progress?
It's definitely the latter. It's always good for the public to share our interest and for us to have that support behind the work that we do. It was not that long ago that we really didn't have much funding or, you know, the support to do work on invertebrates. But in the last 15 years, it's been much better.
So what is Vermont doing? I mean, first of all, just to study, you know, just to study the populations we have, and certainly Brian and Leif can speak to this as well, but to at least know what we have in, you know, 2019 or maybe in 2000, to know then later what we might see growth in or what we might lose by 2050 or 2070.
Exactly, yes. And we've been addressing that over the last 10 or 15 years by doing a number of different large-scale projects where we look at, you know, trying to identify what species we have and where we can some indication of abundance, or at least relative abundance. So as was mentioned already, you know, we've done a butterfly atlas. It was statewide. One of the great things that's happening now is that we're using citizen scientists to help us gather information so we can do a much larger scale of effort than we could before. And this is becoming more popular, and people are starting to really get into it. So it's great. That project was particularly good because not only did we determine what species were out on the landscape, but we asked people to, you know, tell us how much time they were spending, how many they were seeing per hour, that sort of thing. So it kind of gave us a baseline. So we don't know what butterflies we had 10 years ago and what they were like, but at least we had this is kind of our starting point. So this is our base. Maybe in 10 or 15 years, we'll look at it again and see what's happening. We've done the same with dragonflies and odonates to some degree. A bumblebee study that LEAF and Vermont Center for Eco Studies worked on, and we helped support that. We've developed an invertebrate database to start trying to get some of this information this out there in different places, in museums and literature, trying to get it kind of compiled in one place so we can start answering some of these questions, hopefully in the future.
One of the taxa that seems to be particularly affected by the potential for extinction and loss are dung beetles, though. Do we even know in Vermont, you know, what types of dung beetles we have, Mark?
We don't, but we know we have them, and there is some interest. I've only just started getting some notice of this. Someone recently sent me a picture of a dung beetle, and I said, wow, that's great.
So we know we have one.
We know we have one dung beetle.
And, you know, we're going to look at other groups. There's a ladybug project
that's right.
Vermont Center for Eco Studies is going to start. Leaf, we're going to look at more bees, right? Not just bumblebees. We're going to look at other bee species. So we're looking at tiger beetles. The other amazing thing about this is that these, you know, insects sort of defy simplicity. You know, they like exemplify nuance and diversity in all this intellectual curiosity. You know, there are, for example, 2,200 moth species in Vermont that we know of, but there's only 200 bird species. To give you an example, like we've been studying birds for a long time, and we're still learning about the moths in the state. And there are 10 times more moths than there are birds in terms of diversity when it comes to nesting birds in Vermont.
Well, and Brian, you mentioned ladybugs. Aren't there some remarkable number of species of ladybugs where, you know, you see one, you think a ladybug is a ladybug is a ladybug, but perhaps not.
Exactly. That's the thing with insects. Almost invariably, there's never one of them. You know, like we think of lightning bugs, fireflies. We don't know. There's 15 or 20 species of fireflies in Vermont. You know, the dragonflies, one of the groups that I work with, there's almost 150 dragonfly species. You know, so that's what's the challenge and the wonder of insects. You know, there's like 12,000 ant species in the world. And there's only 9 or 10,000 bird species. So there are more ants on the planet than there are all the birds.
Yeah, and not even all the ants are known yet. If you find one, you get to be the namer of your very new ant species. Let's go to John, who's calling in from Hancock. Hi, John.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to comment. I told you, screener, the last 2 years that I garden every summer, and love being outdoors, and the biggest bummer was all the bugs. In the last 2 years, like the end of July, the beginning of August, when the air should just be littered with bugs, there was like virtually no bugs, none. I live in Hancock, you know, it's like a very buggy place in the summer.
Yeah, John, you know, I hear what you're saying, and, you know, while it may feel nice to us not to have so many bugs out in the evenings while we're out gardening or doing whatever, certainly noticing that loss and then wondering, you know, what does that actually mean for the birds that are feeding on those insects, for anything else, you know, pollinators who are out. So, Leaf, what about it? I mean, why should we be so concerned about a loss of insects?
Yeah, well, I first wanted to say that the caller's observation is one that I've heard a lot. I've heard similar observations quite a bit from other people, and I can add my own anecdote that I feel like I see fewer fewer insects in the summer. That would be just generally insects. And we know from these inventories that we've been talking about in Vermont that some of them are truly less common now than they used to be. There are a number of very important functions that insects perform in the ecosystem and in our human economies. So they're very abundant, right? There's just huge biomass of insects, many different species and individuals of them. So they form the base of many food webs. They're important to predator-prey interactions. They're an important structural part of the ecosystems around us. So Vermont's forests and wetlands and other types of natural systems would not be the same without the insects there, whether we're talking about the ones that we think are good guys or the ones that we would rather not be bitten by. They are all part of this interacting system. I also want to highlight that we get many what we call ecosystem services from insects that are important to human beings in terms of our food production systems, because native bees and other insects are very important pollinators. We also get the service of natural pest control from the predators of some of the bugs that chew on our plants in our gardens and our farms. There are some others also. So when we think about the loss of insects, we're thinking about an impoverishment of natural systems that are important intrinsically, but also important because we depend on them. But we're also talking about the human economy, and we are potentially losing a large sum of money when we lose these native insects.
Yeah, talking today about a loss of insects, what that might mean for us here in Vermont, and you know what's being done here as well, and how do we even know what kinds of insects we have in Vermont? Not very much is known about all the many, many insect species around the world. And before we go deeper into what's being done and what can be done, I just want to back up briefly, because one thing that we didn't talk about is why we're seeing such a massive die-off right now, and that then helps inform what we could possibly be doing differently. Mark, can you tick through? It's pesticide use so far that we know of, but not just pesticides. It's not just that pesticides are being used. So what's the sort of picture here of why we're seeing a decline?
Yeah, I think it's probably a number of different causes that are working together. Pesticides can be very pervasive. The ones we've heard a lot about lately are neonicotinoids or neonics that are a systemic pesticide, and that they don't have to have contact with insect to cause death. They will actually permeate throughout a plant. So any use of that plant by an insect will affect it. So you know that's something that is just kind of everywhere right now. But habitat loss is another big one as people become more populous on the state and or in the world and our economy grows, we see more development, we're losing more of the habitat for insects.
And then climate change as well?
Climate change is one as well. Just a few degrees difference in temperature on average can make a big difference to some species.
We got a question from Kate who says, Vermont is not only a beer-producing state, but efforts are underway to grow our own barley to make that beer. It is my understanding that glyphosate, or Roundup, is considered required for growing barley, even though the research shows that it is lethal to insects. So my question is, beer or bees? That is, can we justify using glyphosate on barley or any crops if it kills bees and other insects in a state which wants to be environmentally responsible? Leif Richardson, what do you know about Roundup and glyphosate on bees and other insects? But then, you know, more broadly speaking, how do we balance our needs and desires in this state when it comes to our agriculture?
That's a great set of questions. So I'll start by saying that glyphosate, or Roundup, as it's known by a trade name, is an herbicide, so one type of pesticide that is designed to kill plants, not insects or vertebrates or other organisms. So it's largely harmless to most animals. That would include insects. There is science suggesting there's some sort of there could be harm. There's science suggesting that there is not harm to things other than plants. So there's a lot of discussion about glyphosate right now. I the the question might be about a recent study that showed that glyphosate can actually harm bees, and this is interesting. It's an indirect negative effect. And so the way this works is that this herbicide, glyphosate, has a negative impact on some bacteria that inhabit the guts of honeybees and that benefit the honeybees. So they're symbiotic with the bee. They help the bee digest food and probably detoxify things in their diet. And so if the bee is consuming an herbicide and it takes out the bee's mutualist, the bee might actually suffer. So there's one study showing this for honeybees. We don't know anything about whether it hasn't been replicated, and we also don't know if that is the case for other native insects, like other types of bees. It's certainly possible, and it's a worrying possibility. The question of whether we have to have glyphosate to grow barley is one I'm not an expert on, but there are other herbicides that could be used. There are certainly ways to grow crops without pesticides, and that is something that could be explored also.
Could be, should be, do you think? I mean, should we be thinking more than we currently do about regulating pesticides and herbicides and our growing practices? I mean, we know that there's not an appetite for more regulation, but do you think it should be really heavy-handed at this point?
Yeah, so Mark talked about some of the drivers of decline, and over we see that pesticides are a risk associated with declines of insects. And the group that I work on that I know the best are bumblebees. We recently published this study about the bumblebees in Vermont, where we found sweeping declines, disappearance of about a quarter of the species that are native here, declines of another quarter. So about half of the bumblebees that are native to Vermont are gone or have declined. We did not show that pesticides caused that, but many other studies have shown that pesticides have negative impacts on bees. And so there's some inference that we can make there. So yes, I think that this is a problem. But there's another question here. We have one of the big issues with insect declines in general is just that agriculture is expanding and intensifying, and that includes the pesticides. So we are going to need more food in the near future because we have more people. Some people have made a case that pesticides and other synthetic chemicals should be part of that picture because that would allow us to grow more food on fewer acres. So I'm not saying that I'm advocating that instead of dealing with the direct toxic effects on the insects, but it's not a simple question where I think just banning one product will solve the problem. I actually don't think that's the solution for bees.
CJ in Mansfield wrote in to say, E.O. Wilson recommends setting aside half of the earth for wilderness and preserving biodiversity. He's mapping ecosystems that connect and so forth. CJ asks, does Vermont have a map that identifies half of its area for half Vermont wilderness? Is it necessary to be so selective in wilderness restoration if the goal is to restore that much? Would it be as effective to just go about the business of restoring wilderness at every opportunity and gain as much wilderness as possible as soon as possible? Brian, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, this is the thing about insects. Like I say, they defy simple explanations. And yes, you could say that insect diversity has actually increased in Vermont since the mid-19th century when the state was mostly cleared for pasture land, for sheep. You know, forests generally provide greater insect diversity than pastures. And when it comes to all these drivers, yes, more habitat, diversity of habitat is really important. But insects defy simple explanations. You know, agriculture, the rise of industrial agriculture is certainly a major driver. And the habitat loss and the degradation and fragmentation of habitat that goes with that is a driver. There are biological factors like pathogens, particularly when it comes to bees. There are non-native invasive species. There are things like artificial lighting that we may or may not be concerned about. And then there's climate, which, may be more pronounced for insects in the tropics than in temperate regions. So there are many, many factors working together here. And I think that there are never any easy answers, and there's always diversity when it comes to insects, and there's a diversity of solutions. I mean, even if you look at consolidation of farmland, the hedgerows between smaller farms can provide important habitat for insects. And if you lose those hedgerows and you consolidate farmland, those are impacts as well.
Well, so Brian, you say there are no easy answers. What are the hard ones? I mean, do you have a vision of, you know, if I could rule the world, I would impose these things and we'd all be fine.
Yeah, we would change. We're talking about like kind of the solutions that we on a scale that we talk about when it comes to climate change, you know, political leadership, big changes in the way that we grow crops. But, you know, Jane, actually, there are some easy answers if you are looking locally. You know, you can look at insects hyper-local, like in your own backyard. You can look at these bigger global factors, these socio-political and economic factors. I mean, face it, we have a big imprint, a big footprint on the planet, we humans. We grow a lot of food. We've changed the landscape in some pretty profound ways. And we apply to the land chemicals that are designed to kill insects. But, you know, if we were to come up with some local solutions, you know, we could talk Mark and Leaf. You know, we haven't even talked about this, but I suspect that locally, which is not a global solution, but locally in your own yard or on your own property, mowing is probably and grass is probably one of the greatest threats to insect diversity and abundance. You know, a lawn that you mow, a 10-acre lawn, is basically going to be an insect desert compared to a forest or a field that you brush hog every few years. So there are some easy solutions close to home, but they won't really change the sort of global scale of this problem.
Mark, do you agree? You're giving a great boon to lots of people who hate to mow. Should everybody stop mowing their lawn?
That would be nice. I'm one of those people. Like Brian said, it's kind of a local solution, you know, sort of what's going on your property nearby. But just providing more of a, you know, a diverse landscape and diverse structure for insects and other creatures is really a good way to promote insect diversity in others. You know, leave those fields, if you can, unmowed until late in the season when they've finished their life cycles. You know, woodlands nearby, having those edges, what looks like a rotten log that looks like just, you know, a nuisance to someone, maybe a nice housing opportunity for insects where they can have food, shelter, and raise their young.
You know, there is one other thing. I want to hear from Leaf on this, but if I can say one other thing, I want to embellish what Leaf said earlier about insects as what we call them primary consumers. They're primary converters. And here's the thing. Birds, a lot of the song, we talk a lot about birds on VPR. A lot of the songbirds in our woods, Vermont is a state of forests. Warblers do not eat maple trees, right? They don't eat leaves. They eat insects. Insects eat leaves. So the way for a warbler to benefit from the forests of Vermont are insects that live on those trees. And warblers eat a lot of geometric caterpillars, those little inchworm caterpillars. And so that is one service that insects do. They convert leaves into bird food.
Right? And so
if you start to look at this amazing relationship between insects and plants, and plant diversity, you discover ways to conserve insects. So the greater the plant diversity anywhere, odds are the greater the insect diversity.
Let's go back to the calls. Dana is on the line with us from Brattleboro. Hi, Dana. What are you thinking about today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm thinking about not just like the bug bites that you get that are annoying, but the things that are actually really dangerous, like Lyme disease and carriers of Lyme disease and malaria and things like that. How do we deal with that kind of problem without destroying all of the other insects in the neighborhood?
Yeah, Dana, I'm going to pair your question with a similar one about a different species. So, you know, if we're trying to get rid of ticks, how do we get rid of ticks without getting rid of other bugs? And then Susan in Roxbury references a story that she heard yesterday on the radio about a project in Italy where scientists are genetically engineering mosquitoes in Africa that carry malaria. And the way this would work is these genetically modified lab mosquitoes can't, can't carry on the lineage. So they breed with mosquitoes in the wild, and they spread genes that then cause the mosquitoes to lose the ability to reproduce. And Susan writes, why can't they come up with ways to stop the disease and other diseases in mosquitoes instead of wiping out an entire group of insects? Who knows what the repercussions of this would be? Could scientists put more emphasis on increasing immunity in humans, or actually focus on creating decent and healthy infrastructure for everyone? It seems like the eradication of a species should be an absolute last resort, if it's considered at all. And Leif, I know this isn't your area of expertise, but when you think about that question, that sort of moral question of should we eradicate a species, should we try to get rid of ticks, should we try to get rid of malaria-carrying mosquitoes for the benefit of humans without knowing all of the knock-on effects, you know, how do you sort of think about that in your head?
It's a great question. It's a great set of questions. I am concerned about the thinking that goes along with trying to deal with a human disease by eradicating another species, except for maybe something like smallpox itself. I think removing ticks from the environment will be something we regret if we figure out how to do it. I think that if we can engineer a particular mosquito to fail to breed and then go extinct, we might get lucky and it might stop there, but there may be some unintended consequences. So I'm not advocating that people continue to suffer with preventable human diseases like malaria. These are terrible scourges, and we should be investing more in finding ways of dealing with these problems. But the solutions are really not about just removing insects from our lives. And I wanted to refer back to an earlier part of our conversation, something that Vermonters can do or cannot do if they want to help with insects. I would invite people to just consider this. In Vermont, we have a few cases of some very deadly diseases like equine encephalitis that are carried by mosquitoes. And our approach, one of our approaches is vigilance to try to find those mosquitoes. Another is we have mosquito control districts where we spray some pesticides that might kill mosquitoes and other flies, but not other types of insects. That's great if we get rid of the mosquito and thus the disease that is causing the problem for people and let's say horses. But we have no idea what else we're killing in that case. So in the case of mosquito control in Vermont, we're probably losing a ton of other fly species. Mosquitoes are flies. And flies are important to the environment. They're critical to in some of the ways that Brian described earlier. So if we want to have birds, if we want to have healthy forests, we probably need flies. So I think it's just something that you have to consider. There's a cost to fighting human diseases that are caused by or mitigated by insects, and we have to think very carefully about that.
Well, Mark, as part of the Fish and Wildlife Department, when you think carefully about policies that the state could have, and I realize you don't have control over agricultural policies, but if you care, as you do, about our insect populations and about our ecosystems as a whole and the role that insects play, what do you hope that we do broader than just individuals not mowing their lawns? You know, what are you hoping we take action on?
Well, I think the policy part of it is going to be really important. And yeah, there's so many interests that are involved with something like pesticide use. The state of Vermont and many other states recently put together pollinator protection committees. Leaf was on ours and came up with recommendations for what to do. And I guess for me, one of the most important things about that was a discussion took place about pesticides and some of the issues around them. So, you know, I think we gained some ground there, and I hope we continue with that.
Brian, you got 30 seconds to tell us how to solve this problem.
Well, you know, I mean, mowing on public lands as well is something that we need to look at. I think the more that we can increase plant diversity, I mean, this is a simplistic in my answer in my 30 seconds, the more we'll increase insect diversity. And then the other thing is recognition. Look at these insects. Learn them. Learn something. Just pick one and learn it. And once you see it, you'll care more and you'll start to think more about options for saving, not just the one you care about, but lots of others as well.
Brian Pfeiffer is a field entomologist and a writer. Brian, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome, Jane.
Mark Ferguson is a zoologist with the Fish and Wildlife Department. Mark, thanks for your time as well.
Thanks, Jane.
And Leif Richardson is an ecologist at UVM. His work focuses on plants and pollinators. Leif, it's nice to talk with you today.
Thanks, Jane.